Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today, we're welcoming one of the most high-profile guests that we've ever had on our show, Oscar Goodman. Goodman went from the top defense attorney for some of the most notorious mobsters in the country, including Frank Rosenthal, to being the mayor of Las Vegas more than once. He'll be talking about his memoir, Being Oscar, which details some of the most exciting cases he's ever been a part of, as well as telling his side of the controversial three terms as mayor of Sin City. He's the only man who could snub President Obama, hobnob with gangsters, and get Scorsese to make a movie about him.
How did the man who came to symbolize Vegas stay married to the same woman his whole life? What's his moral stance on defending some of the most vicious gangsters in American history? And how did he both change Vegas for the better and get voted, quote, meanest mayor in America?
We'll find out all of this and much more. Oscar, welcome. I really, really do appreciate you coming on your show. Your book was quite interesting. I have another book out that I read called Tough Jews. My dad was one.
I've read the book.
My father was one of 12, and 9 of his brothers were boxers, so I come from that tough Jew family.
Yes, well, one of my chapters, of course, is about the boxers that I have represented, but how it all started when I was growing up in Philadelphia. My father would take me to a restaurant called Lou Tendler's, which was next to his law office there, and all the fighters would congregate there, and their pictures were there, and I heard the stories of Barney Ross and all the tough fighters, that Benny Leonard, Max Baer, all of those that represented all that was good in the fight game, and I fell in love with it. And then over the years, I represented guys like Don King and Larry Holmes and Mike Tyson, and the fight game was certainly part of my life. So I understand what tough guys are.
Well, I'm sure you do, considering a lot of the people you represented. What did bring you? You're a Jewish kid from a tough Philadelphia neighborhood, Irish neighborhood. I could considerably relate to that. I grew up in Garrison Beach. I was probably the only Jew among the entire Irish. What brought you to Las Vegas, and what made you decide to actually become a lawyer?
Well, I was thinking of doing a lot of things other than becoming a lawyer, but my wife didn't care for any of the choices and suggested that I go to law school instead of going into the Army, and it wasn't a bad idea at the time. So I went to law school, and when I was in law school, I hated law school. I went to a great law school, University of Pennsylvania, and I fell in love with some of the professors there, but it was a day that the civil rights movement was very, very active, and the students at Penn really were more interested in becoming corporate lawyers, getting involved in business and the like, and that really never interested me. I had gone to Haverford College, which was a very liberal arts school, and had taken courses in philosophy and sociology and things that really don't do you much good as far as making a living, but do expand the mind. And I really missed that Elysian-type environment when I went to school. So I got married a year after I began law school, and my wife was supporting us, and I just didn't feel right about that. So one day I just took it on my own and walked down to City Hall, which is about 20 blocks from the Penn campus, and walked right up to the DA's office and asked to see the district attorney. I didn't know him from Adam. And I went in and he greeted me. He was very, very nice and turned me over to one of his assistants. And I said, I really would like a job. I need to do something to divert my attention from just the rigors of law school. And he said, well, we have a great guy here, Arlen Specter. Arlen just won the first conviction of a Teamster official in the United States, and he was on cloud 9, and he was looking for a clerk, and they sent me into Arlen, and Arlen hired me as his clerk. He was a great mentor. He was a meticulous lawyer, and I got $1 an hour. I worked a 40-hour week. I think I'm the only fellow at an Ivy League law school that worked a 40-hour week, and I loved it. I loved going down there every single day and being under his tutelage, and there came a time when a wealthy widow was killed, and the fellows who killed her took $300,000 from under her mattress, and went out to Las Vegas to launder it in the traditional sense at the crap tables here. And Arlen assigned me to work up the testimony of the police officers who participated in their arrest in Las Vegas and a search and seizure that took place in Las Vegas. And I was talking to these two officers. It was a cold, dreary, like the winters that the East is now having, which is so sad. A cold winter where the wind was blowing through this old stone city hall, and it was chilled and it was depressing. And they said at the end of the interview, they said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Where else is there?" So they said, "Las Vegas." I never even thought of it. They said, "It's a land of opportunity." So I went home that night. I woke my wife up and I said, "Sweetheart, how would you like to go to the land of milk and honey?" She said, "I'm not going to Israel." And I said, "No, Las Vegas."
I saw that coming, Oscar.
Yeah, I said, right, you did. Not that she didn't. We've been to Israel many times since then. But I said, "How would you like to do that?" And she was great. She said, "Whatever you want is fine with me." So we applied to the district attorney of Las Vegas. There was no such animal. It's the district attorney of Clark County, actually, but it got in the right hands, and they invited us out, and we went out there, and on a Saturday morning, and instead of being in Temple, I walked around the city downtown and went into law offices. All the lawyers would work on Saturday morning, and I went from one to another, and I said, "If you were a young lawyer and you were looking to start your career, would you come to Las Vegas?" And without exception, they all said, "Yes, the opportunities here are limitless." And we came out and never had a bad day.
How did you get involved defending the mob?
Well, it was all by accident. You know, I was a young lawyer. Well, I wasn't even a lawyer at the time. I was a law clerk for the DA while I was studying for the bar exam here. And Carolyn, my dear wife, and myself received a wonderful gift from my father. He would send us $25 a week to... it was our wedding gift, basically, to be spent on things of pleasure and not things of necessity. We weren't allowed to, so well, the request was don't spend it on your rent, don't spend it on your gasoline, don't go out, have a meal, see a movie, see a show, that kind of thing. And I would take her, after we would save a little money up, to a place which is now imploded, and where the Mandalay Bay presently stands in Las Vegas, a place called the Hacienda Hotel, and we would have dinner in their steakhouse, which was called the Charcoal Room. And in those days, the price of steaks, because they wanted to get you into the casinos and keep you there, were very, very reasonable. And at the end of dinner, she would take $20 and go over to the blackjack table, and without knowing it, she really was one of the first of the counters. She was able to follow the cards, and she invariably won, and I would stand behind her. I did not want to play because I felt that they didn't build these beautiful places because of people winning. And I would talk to the dealer who was dealing the cards, and we became very, very friendly. And one day after I got licensed, he called me up, and he said, "You know, Oscar, I'm in a little financial difficulty here. Could you file a bankruptcy petition for me?" Which I did. And I had a little law office at that time over a flower shop. It was very romantic. And he came down. I had a little bridge table that I was working off of. And we wrote the bankruptcy petition out by longhand. And he paid me, I think, $250, including all the costs. And he was happy. I was happy. And we became friends. And then a phone call came into the Hacienda Pit shortly thereafter. The phone call was from an alleged mobster, a fellow who is reputed to be the head of a gambling operation in the Northeast United States and in Canada. He said that his stepbrother, who he hadn't seen in years, had been arrested in Las Vegas, and he wanted the best criminal lawyer in Las Vegas. So the fellow who answered the phone, instead of saying, "I don't know who the best criminal lawyer is in Las Vegas," he cups the phone and he says in the pit, "Who's the best criminal lawyer in Las Vegas?" And the fellow I did the bankruptcy for said, "Call Oscar." And that's the way it all started.
Let me ask this question because it's interesting. You worked in the DA's office. You clerked. And I remember as a kid, I remember watching when Ruby shot on national TV when he killed Oswald. And I'm thinking, and I've seen this so often, you know, I grew up in Brooklyn, where you see an actual murder take place in front of your eyes, in front of thousands of people's eyes, and then the person says not guilty.
Yes.
So the question here that I'm curious about is that there are some people who get caught up in illegal things and they really don't know what they're doing, and there's really reason to believe that they're, even though they are guilty by virtue of the fact they broke the law, you know, there's some play in it. But you defended Meyer Lansky. Now, Meyer Lansky is no one on this planet thinks this guy is innocent of anything. What for you is the justification of defending someone who is absolutely known as one of the shrewdest businessmen, but absolutely a ruthless killer?
Well, number one, I never represented him on any kind of a murder charge. That's number one. I don't believe he was ever charged with murder or ever went to trial. It's like you fall into the same trap that a lot of people do when the government, instead of solving crimes, they go to the media and they create monsters. And all my clients killed 26 people, according to the government. Not 27, not 24. It's always 26. That's the number. And I'm saying to these FBI agents who were screaming and yelling at me, how can you represent this guy who killed 26 people? I said, shame on you.
Hey, but there have got to be times when you turned a blind eye.
Why do you let him kill 26 people if you really believe that? Why don't you prosecute him and convict him? And that's the whole story. And I say in the book, and an example that I always used in front of juries, because most people don't know what they did when they're charged with a crime as to the technical aspects of it. You go home, and I put it in the book, Being Oscar, you go home and you see your front door has been jimmied open. You see that your a bureau in your bedroom has been gone through. You get this horrible feeling that your privacy has been invaded, and you see your TV is missing, and you pick up the phone and you call 911 and you say, I was what?
I was robbed.
No, you weren't robbed. You were burglarized. And there's a big difference. It's about 15 years to the guy who's convicted of it. Robbery is taking something by force or threat of force. Burglary is entering with the intent to commit a felony. So I don't want to hear, my clients, the only questions I ever asked my client, I said, they're saying that you did something at 12 o'clock on February the 28th. Where were you at 12 o'clock on February 28th? If you weren't where they say you were, if they have an alibi, then I want to hear about it. But I don't want to hear them say, well, I did this or did that. They don't know what they did. So I was, in a traditional sense, even though it has a negative connotation now, I was their mouthpiece. I was their voice. I was the man who protected their constitutional rights. And because they were reputed to be very bad people, when I was able to protect their rights and make sure that law enforcement, who supposedly were the white hats, but many times I felt they were the black hats, violated those rights and violated their civil rights and breached the constitutional protections. When I protected these very, very bad, supposedly bad people, I was protecting your rights vicariously, because if I wasn't going to let the government get away with violating the Constitution for my clients, then you were inured to the benefit vicariously of having your rights protected. So I never had a hard time sleeping, believe me. And when you talk about Lansky, I represented him out here on a skim case, which is a nonviolent crime that he was charged with. He was charged with being a hidden owner of one of the casinos here, and they would allegedly take money before they would pay taxes on it and put it in their pockets instead of declare it. And not the most offensive, horrible thing in the world. It really didn't hurt too many people other than the IRS, assuming that they did it. And he never even went to trial out here. He was so ill, I was able to convince the judge that he wouldn't be able to stand the rigors of trial. And the judge dismissed the case to the great displeasure of a lot of IRS agents and FBI agents and prosecutors who went crazy that, you know, Lansky walked, but he should have walked. And if you were in as bad a health condition as he was, you should have walked. So no problem.
Wait a minute. Lots of times you must have turned a blind eye. You must have known these people were guilty.
You sound like a judge who wrote an opinion that every prosecutor ever got had to come from an illegal source.
I'm going to ask you differently for a second. Okay. I'm going to ask you differently. We know that the mafia exists, and we know that they don't exist as a mediation corporation, that they don't exist because they act basically upon reason and cut good deals, that they do have, they built what they built through force, intimidation, murder, and threats. Now, very often it was against each other, not against always the innocent person.
Yeah, as my mother used to say, Oscar's clients never hurt anybody, they just killed each other.
Right. And then that's the case. So, but the question that I have is that when a lawyer knows that his client, in, let's say, defending him against a murder, didn't commit the 26 murders, but he did commit some.
Is that the way the system's supposed to work?
But that's my question I'm asking you. My question to you is this. Is the job of the lawyer to simply get the client off, or is the job of the lawyer to bring justice to
the lawyer is to protect the client's rights and to make sure the prosecution is able to gather its evidence legally according to our Constitution that a lot of people died to defend, and number two, that they were able to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, if they were able to do that, believe me, when I tell you this on my oath, I never had a client complain if they were convicted. But in most of the cases, the government violated the law, and they didn't prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's why I was a halfway successful lawyer. So the system is a great system. It's the best system. Now, I think what you would like to see is what's called a Scottish verdict, and that is when a jury returns a verdict, they're not saying whether a client is guilty or not guilty. They're saying on a Scottish verdict, not proven. And you would feel much more comfortable that there was a system like that, but that's not our system in this country.
I don't know what system I would feel comfortable in because I really didn't give it much thought. I just question, you know, a doctor's oath is to simply look out for the patient, okay? And that's it's quite very simple. He has to take care of the patient to the best of his ability. But not necessarily at the expense if this patient had a disease that that could spread, you know, to tens of thousands of people, he would have to take that into consideration. So I'm questioning whether or not, and I do understand that what you're telling me is that your job is to protect your client, and by doing that, you're protecting the Constitution, and by doing that, you're protecting just about everyone. I do want to ask you this question. What cheap tactics does the government use in the courtroom?
What kind of tactics?
Yes.
In what way?
Meaning, how are they in many ways guilty of the very same type of crimes?
That's a good one. You read my book, I hope.
Yes.
Okay.
But my audience hasn't, so that's why we're asking.
Well, I hope
you
that they read it because it's a good book, and it's a book that tells it the way it is, and I don't hold back any punches. One of my favorite stories in the book is my representation of a reputed heroin dealer, which is a very, very bad thing to be, by the name of Manny Baker. And Manny, according to the government, when he was indicted, had gone down to the Texarkana airport to meet another reputed drug dealer who was coming in on a flight from San Diego, and they were going to negotiate a drug transaction, and a law enforcement had gotten word from an informant that this was going to take place, and they put out a surveillance at the airport there, and they arrested the fellow coming off the plane, and while they were doing that, Manny was sitting outside in front of the airport in his car waiting for something to take place, and the four red-necked, big, fat cops came up to the car and participated in an exercise with Manny. And there's a rule called exclusionary rule where you can ask that witnesses who are not testifying be excused from the courtroom while another witness testifies, so that they won't be able to hear what the person does and then shape their testimony accordingly. And I invoke the exclusionary rule. So the first big fat redneck cop gets on the stand, and he testifies as follows. He says, we went up to the car and there was this gentleman sitting in the car. Well, nobody ever called Manny Baker a gentleman. Okay. That's the first, the antenna started to go up on that one. And we asked him to roll down his window, and he rolled down his window, and we said, sir, would you mind if you get out of the car and hand us the keys? And they said, oh, well, they said, Manny said, no problem. Well, I knew Manny was around a long time, and a lot of people may not like Manny, but that's not the moral of the story. That's not the issue here. And they said Manny got out of the car, and they said Manny handed over the keys to him, which I know Manny would have never done. And I'm saying to myself, well, you know, here's a big fat redneck cop and a black reputed heroin dealer sitting next to me. They're going to believe this fat cop. And he said that they asked Manny whether or not they could take the key and open up his trunk, and they didn't have a warrant, of course. And I know Manny was smart enough to say no, but they said, they said, certainly go ahead. And they opened the trunk, and they said, oh, there's a bag here. Do you mind if we open the bag? And they said, Manny said, no, go ahead and open it. And they found like $260,000 in the bag. And he said, then we placed Manny under arrest. Well, Manny is sitting next to me, and he says, Mr. Goodman, they're lying. I said, Manny, you're a black guy, okay? They're going to believe this fat redneck cop. Now, let me do my thing, and let me ask some questions. And the guy was steadfast in his story. They excuse him. Next cop comes on, like hand in glove, word for word. They're lying, Mr. Goodman. They're lying, Mr. Goodman. Next cop comes on, word for word. They had gone to the same acting school. They learned the same part. I said, this is ridiculous to myself, but, you know, I'm representing a black guy, a reputed heroin dealer, and these are cops. These are guys who are supposed to enforce the law and supposed to protect the Constitution. They're wearing the uniform. And the last one gets on, and he says, Mr. Goodman, they're lying, and I know they're lying, and the people in the van know they're lying. I said, what are you talking about, Manny? I said, you've been babbling, and I'm trying to hear these guys. What are you talking about? He says, you know, the people in the van? I said, what van? He said, you know, when you go to the airport and the people get off the plane, the pilot and the flight attendants, they get into a van and go to a hotel? He said, they saw it all. I said, what are you talking about? He says, the van was there. They had to have seen it. I said, whoa, time out. I said to the judge, I said, Your Honor, I need a recess. I think I have something very important to bring to the court's attention. Well, the judges, you know, they didn't want to hear that I needed a recess. Justice has to move on. Justice delayed is justice denied. And this particular judge is a very decent guy. And he said, Mr. Goodman, if you're representing to me that you'll be here tomorrow morning and we'll continue this thing and whatever you have to do, you'll do between now and then, you got your recess. So we get a recess. I asked a fellow in my office, I said, you know, I know that the flight, it's an American Eagle. It originated in San Francisco and then went to San Diego and then went to Texarkana. Find me the pilot. Well, this guy was pretty good in my office. He found me a pilot who was on that flight in about an hour and a half. I called the pilot up and I said, did you happen to see an incident at the Texarkana airport that was interesting? And he began to talk to me and tell me what he saw. And I said, will you come down and testify? I'm happy to pay for your ticket. I'm happy to get you a hotel room. You just tell the judge the truth as to what you saw. He said, sure, I'll come down. Came down, he gets on the witness stand. You know what he said? He said it was like Miami Vice. He said these four cops came up to the car. They pulled this guy out. They put his face in the gutter. They put handcuffs behind his back. They started to stomp on his back. They had a gun to his head. They took the key out of the ignition. They went to the trunk. They opened it up, and that's what happened. Well, as far as I was concerned, these four cops should have been charged with perjury. They should have lost their job. No. The judge granted my motion to suppress, and Manny went free, which I guess is a very, very bad thing in this country, that a person who appears to have done something wrong goes free. But when you balance what happened with the four fat redneck cops and their lies under oath, and it could have happened to anybody in the world, against the constable going three. I just don't see a problem.
Speaking of heroin, since that came up, you would like to legalize drugs in Las Vegas?
At least I'd like to have the discussion of legalizing drugs. See, I'm a product of the war against drugs and Nancy Reagan and all of that nonsense that they're going to be able to stop drugs from being sold and used. It's a bunch of nonsense. For every drug dealer they get, they just arrested this guy apparently down in Mexico. They're going to extradite him. There'll be 50 people to take his place. The only way to resolve the problem, in my opinion, and I have been doing it for almost a half a century, would be to legalize them and then to educate people as to the danger and the horror of using these drugs. The same way that we've made inroads with drunk driving, we tell people, we tell young people in particular that you don't want to drink and drive. You want to get a designated driver.
Whoa. I want to stop you for 1 minute. You've got to tell the story about what you told those fourth graders.
Well, I told them the truth. I love youngsters, and I have four of my own. They're very successful. I have one who's an MD, PhD, who's an oncologist. I've got another one who's a judge. I have another one who's a lawyer. I have a daughter who's a family therapist. They've all done very, very well, and they love to read, and I love to read to them when they were growing up. So when I was a mayor, I continued to do that. I would go to a school once or twice a week around town and read a story. My favorite story was the real story of the three pigs. They talk about the wolf not being as bad as everybody thinks the wolf was. And I read that story to the kids, and I opened myself up for questions. And I guess some youngster in fourth grade at the school raises his hand says, Mayor, if you were on a desert island in the middle of the ocean, what's the one thing you would want? Well, I guess some of your listeners would like me to say, the Old Testament. But I told him the truth. I said, I'd like a bottle of gin.
Oh, but what kind of gin? And why
Bombay
did you...
Bombay Sapphire, because I'm the spokesperson for it.
Why did you become a spokesperson?
Why? Because they gave me $100,000, which I gave to charity. That's
okay, all right. But right. At the same time, I mean, ethically, this crosses a line, don't you think?
Crossing what line?
Well, I mean, it borders on bribery. I mean, you've
what?
Got, well, you're given money to promote a product when you are mayor of a city.
What did I do? I didn't put it in my pocket. I gave it to charity, I said.
Well, it doesn't matter. It's like a doctor.
It doesn't matter? I fed a lot of poor people who were homeless and gave a lot of kids scholarships that couldn't afford to go to the school. I think that's pretty nice.
Yeah, but you've got...
I feel sorry for you if you think that way. Really. What are you, two moralists there?
Look, I'm not a killjoy.
Let's be honest with one another.
Oh, come on. I'm not a killjoy.
Life is real, and if you could get $100,000 to give to charity... and enjoy a good martini, and you don't take it, you should be certified.
I should give you an example of that in the medical profession. In the medical profession, you cannot take samples from drug companies. I mean,
they all do.
Okay, but it's considered unethical. It's not part of the medical code, and it would be.
I'm not a doctor.
I didn't say that. Right. But you're running a city, and you've got 15.1 million alcoholics in America. It's rising. It's a problem, and you tell fourth graders that it's a good. It's really cool.
You know, not one kid knew what gin was.
No. Well, they're going to find out.
Oh, they found out. It's funny. It's funny how it became a political thing because when I left the school, all the teachers came up to me and all the principals. They said, that was wonderful. We had a great time. Will you come back? And I get back to my office, and there was a maelstrom. It was amazing. I mean, AP, UPI, they were all calling, how can I tell children to drink gin? Well, I said, there you go again.
You know what, Oscar? I don't think you're telling people to drink gin, this is an informational program, and you are a fascinating character. And so, along the lines of that, because a lot of what you're saying, I really want to kind of understand your thought process. I don't really have an opinion until I actually hear the thought process, and then I can have an educated opinion.
Sure.
You made a statement in your book, Hitler's Germany inspired the kind of lawyer you are. Tell me what you meant by that.
Well, I saw what happens when you have a despot who has a certain charisma about him. I mean, here is an ugly little man with a sort of a doughy face and a stupid little mustache that looked like a dead moth under his nose, who was able to rally millions of people to send human beings, no matter who they were, be they gypsy, be they homosexual, be they Jews, it didn't matter, into concentration camps where they were then gassed. When I saw something like that happening, I said, you know, somebody has to stand up and has to say that you have to fight to make sure that doesn't happen again. And of course, it was Hitler who had taken the Shakespeare quote of "Let's kill all the lawyers first." Now, a lot of people think that's very, very funny. But what Shakespeare was saying and what Hitler was saying, let's get rid of the lawyers who are going to resist what we're doing and protect rights of people, and then we'll be able to do it so much more quickly, and we'll be able to solve we'll be able to enact the ultimate solution. So I studied those kinds of things, and I've read about them, and to me, it's a lesson. There's still some idiots who deny that the Holocaust ever took place. I mean, I've been through this not only as far as World War II, but with the 1915 Turkish-Armenian genocide that took place. I mean, people deny the facts and the truth, and you can't do that. You have to say, yes, there was a horrible time in the history of the world, and we have to make sure that it never happens again. And that's all I was saying when I said that.
Oscar, and that actually makes sense to me. Question, though, why are there so many lawyer jokes? And do you really believe, or do you believe, that lawyers are inherently more ethical, you know, than the average person out there, including those who are in organized crime?
No, I don't say the lawyers are more ethical or less ethical. I'll tell you this, that there are certain pitfalls that a lawyer faces if he breaches the ethics to the point that he's going to be sanctioned. I mean, you lose your license. It's like it's an interesting thing. I talk about discussing, advocating legalization of drugs. I never even had a puff of a marijuana cigarette, and I've heard from people who have smoked marijuana and who have gotten a great benefit from it as far as a medical condition is concerned. People with glaucoma, people with great pain, and it makes a lot of sense to me. But if it was illegal, in a misdemeanor status, I wasn't about to do it because I did not want to lose what I called my ticket. I didn't want to lose my license of practicing law, so I would never have engaged in that. But do I think that medical marijuana is something that should absolutely be enacted? Absolutely. No question about it. I have no hesitation saying that at all. That's a whole different issue than legalization of drugs across the board.
I think that's true. Meaning legalization of medical marijuana is not legalization, you know, of crack cocaine or methamphetamine.
It's a different story. But what I was saying in my book is this. I was saying that, you know, people can't be scared to talk about things. Nobody ever got hurt from a conversation, Nobody ever got hurt from a discussion. That's how we improve ourselves. As you say, if you understand something, if you hear an explanation and you agree with it, then you can accept it, even though you may not necessarily agree with it. And that's all I was saying when it came. I mean, this whole thing about prostitution. Now, certainly, a lot of people morally and legally can say it's very, very demeaning to women. And it enables very, very bad people to take advantage of them. But I've had experience representing prostitutes, and many of them are supporting their family as a result of this activity. They are not using...
Now, Oscar, we're not talking about women who were brought in here as slaves, correct?
No, we're not talking about minors. We're not talking about children. We're not talking about people who are being forced to do something. I'm talking about people who want to make a considered voluntary judgment that that's the way they want to spend their life. I don't think I'd like to see my daughter as a prostitute. I'm sure I wouldn't. But I've met a lot of prostitutes. I've represented a lot of prostitutes. I represented a lot of houses of prostitution, because outside of Washoe County, where Reno is situated, and Clark County, where Las Vegas is situated, it's a county option as to whether or not the counties in Nevada want to allow legalized prostitution to take place. And I visited these brothels, not as a customer, but as a lawyer who had to represent the owner or the girls on occasion. And none of them were being forced into slavery or forced into a position that they found to be abhorrent. To suggest, you know, a lot of people think the prostitution is legal in Las Vegas because they see these young ladies frequent the various hotels and leave the hotels early in the morning. It's like a parade coming out of some of these places early in the morning. You know it's taking place, and you know that there are people who come into town and they're taken advantage of here by the street prostitutes who will do acts that you can't even imagine for $20 in a car in some alley. And all I was saying, have a discussion, see whether it makes any sense. It could be a revenue device. It could be a safety device to make sure that somebody's not being rolled. It could be a health device, making sure that there's no sexually transmitted diseases, all those kind of things. And I get a kick out of it when people don't want to talk about it. I say, well, are you going to get hurt talking about it? And that's something I've not been able to understand, why people don't want to have a discussion about anything. Voice their opinion, yay or nay. That's what I was saying when I said those things should be discussed.
I'd like to open a discussion. Let's have a conversation about that, about prostitution.
Okay.
In my book, I wrote a book called Seductress. Now, I'm a sex-positive feminist. So
you are what?
Sex-positive feminist. Those are feminists who are very pro-female sexuality. My
Good.
Distinction between prostitution and being a courtesan is that a courtesan can choose the men that she wants to have sex with and can fix the price. The difference is that prostitutes and whores, if you want to put it in those terms, are at the mercy of the person. Like the old saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So the man is the one who is in control, in charge, and can choose the sexual activity which may actually hurt a woman. Now, I know Mustang Ranch and those places, they did a nice show for you probably and made all the women look very happy. But those women, don't you think that they were probably doing things they wouldn't really want to do and probably weren't getting equal pleasure? It was all about male pleasure. I mean, they're in the business of that.
I think you're right. I think that Heidi Fleiss probably didn't have a bad idea when she was going to open up one of these places and have mm-hmm. Male prostitutes.
Yeah. And why hasn't that taken off, do you think?
It wasn't successful. They tried it. As I understand it, she tried it, and for some reason it never caught on, although I've had women tell me that they would certainly, well, they're gigolos out there. I assume that it's fairly mm-hmm. similar. It's a matter of taste, but I don't disagree with you.
Yeah, I just think it takes a toll on women, both physically and psychologically.
I don't disagree with that. Mm-hmm. When I think of the girls, I'm thinking basically of a high class type call girl, similar to the way the character in Casino De Niro's wife is portrayed by Sharon Stone, that kind of thing. Who go out there and they gamble and they shoot the dice and they put some money in their pocket and then they have an assignation with the man who brought them to the dance, so to speak. That's a different story than what we're talking about. But all I'm saying is, I think it's interesting that you do understand the difference, and there is a difference. I think that people should talk about things like this. Nobody gets hurt by it.
Oscar, I want to ask you a question. There was a movie, which you probably will know the name of it, because today my memory is not working, where the star of the movie says to this cop, it's not what's true, it's what you could prove. Doesn't matter what's true.
There's a lot of truth to that.
Excuse me?
there's a lot of truth to that statement.
Okay. So I want to ask you this, because it's one of the stories in your book that actually I found fascinating. At one point, you were representing an oral surgeon who was accused of sexually abusing patients under anesthesia.
Yeah, seven patients who testified that he sexually assaulted them while they were under the influence of an anesthetic cocktail. Mm-hmm. And seven people who picked up those patients to drive them home because they had that cocktail and they were dizzy, and who heard the patient say that the doctor did so-and-so to me. And after the indictment was returned, three more patients came forward, and three more people who gave him the ride came forward to testify to the same thing. And I did represent this doctor.
And you got him off. And
I didn't get him off. The jury found him not guilty.
Correct. Do you think he was guilty?
Do I think he was guilty?
Yes.
It's not up to me to make that decision.
No, I'm not asking you about a decision. I'm asking you about your thoughts.
It really didn't matter to me whether he did it or not. It mattered to me whether or not the prosecution could prove it. This guy was looking at getting 1,500 years in prison if he were found guilty.
You're saying, if I'm hearing you correct, because I do want to make sure I'm hearing you correct.
Yes.
Whether a crime takes place or not is not the issue. It's whether or not a person could prove that it took place is the issue.
Well, no, there are different roles in our system of justice here.
Well, you basically said you didn't care if he did it or not.
Well, I'm not a moralist in the sense that was not my job. My job was to make sure that all of his rights were protected, and that's what I did.
Would you care if one of those clients...
vigorous cross-examination, and I'll tell you something.
No, but I just want to know this honestly.
I don't think he did it. I think it was a question of the Salem witch hunt, where somebody came forward, they said he did it, and then it was whispering down the lane, and the other women said that he did it, and they said that people do not have hallucinations of sexual nature while they're under the influence of this anesthetic cocktail. And I brought a witness on who was the head of the medical, I guess it's called, I have a hard time pronouncing the word, the ear, nose, and throat people that this particular physician was licensed as.
I'm just happy that someone else's memory is failing.
I came on the witness stand, and I asked him whether or not anybody ever hallucinates, and he said, absolutely not. Your client's crazy to even suggest something like that. And then the next witness I called was one of that doctor's, the witness's patients, who absolutely said that this doctor that just had testified that hallucinations never take place took her out to the desert and raped her and assaulted her. And the jury's looking. I mean, they can't believe what they're hearing here. And the woman really believed that this doctor, who was a legitimate guy, did those things. So I was able to show that they all had, you know, even if they didn't talk to each other, would you ever think that maybe a prosecutor would say in preparing a witness, you know, witness A, victim A, said that so-and-so happened to him, and he tells that to victim B, and then victim B repeats it. That's the way these things, that's how you got people hung in Salem, Massachusetts, who are accused of being witches, and I don't know any witches.
Okay, so there's a yellow line through my pad, which means my producer wants to ask this question. So throughout a incredibly rich life in Las Vegas, and you were married the whole time, you literally were a superstar.
Years.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you ever cheat on your wife?
No.
I like that.
I'd be scared to. You know why? And besides the fact that I love her and I would never do that.
She's made, she's the cousin of Meyer Lansky.
If I ever did anything like that and she caught me, she would be down at the vault. She would she'd take everything out of it. She'd have a metal detector in my backyard looking for cans filled with money, and I would be out on the street.
Well, you know, I was really surprised by the episode you describe where you're taken into the Playboy suite and allowed to take a photo of Miss January.
No, she was Miss July.
Oh, sorry, Miss July. Okay.
And she was gorgeous.
And she was Russian. Okay. Anyway,
she was very intelligent. As a matter of fact,
yeah.
she was used as their interpreter when they would go into Russian-speaking type countries.
Well,
so not only was she beautiful, but she was very smart.
Yeah, but I can understand your reaction at all. I mean,
what's that?
Well, you just decompensated. I mean, you had to take the picture of Hefner off the wall, and, you know, and this body just drove you crazy, and you had to take these pictures, and there was a lot of hoopla about this naked woman. I wrote a book called Swoon. This is about the great seducers of history and today and so on. And I always asked him this question. I said, you know, how do you feel, you know, when you see strippers and naked women and so on? And they say, really? You know, it just doesn't interest me. Maybe they were kidding me. I don't know. But I was surprised. And I guess it's because my husband's a doctor and he sees dozens of naked models every day. And I was just astonished, you know, at the impact of all of this.
Why? Well, she's a beautiful lady.
Yeah, but
she's a beautiful lady, mm-hmm. and it's very funny. Somebody who I guess was astonished as you are,
mm-hmm.
I called my wife and said, "What do you think of your husband taking pictures for Playboy of a naked woman?" And my wife is very cool. I mean, she's an educator. She's intelligent. She's a Bryn Mawr graduate. She's pretty, she's smart, she's self-confident, and she says, "Look, all I could tell you is when he came home, he had a smile on his face."
You know what? I actually am not astonished. If you have been loyal to your wife for all these years, which means that you've always ate at the same restaurant, the fact that you made such a fuss because there was something new and different, and your wife trusted you enough. That it didn't matter where you got your appetite, it mattered where you ate dinner, then you know, I can understand that.
Look, there were 20 people.
What I don't understand is when some of the people who you represented in the mob, they took your children on trips, and
that's not accurate.
Some
of my clients took my children on trips, but my children did not go. With any of the people that the government said were reputed mobsters.
Did not. Okay, so the clients that took them on trips were not accused of anything that was of a violent nature?
No.
Okay.
I want to ask a question about education, because I thought your ideas about reforming education were interesting.
Well, I'll tell you this. I think that the country is dumbed down. I compare us to, my wife founded the first nonprofit, non-sectarian private school in Nevada, and there's mm-hmm. no question that there are certain cultures that I think value education more than perhaps other cultures, and I think it begins at home. I think that we set our standards way too low. Our children should be able to read before they go to kindergarten, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why they can't if a parent will spend time with them. I really believe that there has to be a concerted effort to make sure that the parents do what parents are supposed to do, and that is to raise their children in an environment where the children has a thirst for knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and they help the child get to that point. By being a parent who really cares. Now, a lot of parents are working parents, and they don't have the time to do that, but they can still give support to their children to make sure that at least the homework is done and show some interest in what's happening in school. I think it really begins when the youngster is very, very, very young. I'm not a psychologist, but I understand that the formative years are from birth to about six, and that's when all the habits are deeply ingrained in the kids. And I'm not allowed to say kids, by the way. I have to say children, because kids, mm-hmm. according to my wife, are baby goats. So
she's right.
But you didn't really mean what you said.
About corporal
punishment and bringing that back to the classroom.
Oh, I do.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, maybe you could explain that again.
I believe in the deterrent effect of the law, too, which we've completely given up on.
What kind of corporal punishment?
What kind of corporal punishment? A slap on the tush?
Okay.
let me ask you a question. What was it like dealing with famous mobsters? Frank Rosenthal.
Like they said, please. They said, thank you. They were nice to my staff. They paid me a lot of money. They were always very, very grateful. Even those who went to prison would refer me clients from that prison because they knew that I tried very, very hard to make sure that I did my very, very best for them. So they were a great clientele. They gave me a forum where I could defend the Constitution. I was one of the luckiest lawyers in the history of the world because they all had horrible legal problems. They were subjected to searches, subpoenas, indictments, and I had the opportunity to really make the law work and to test it and to try new things and to challenge old things. And they gave me a forum that I could show that I was a halfway decent lawyer. So
would you be comfortable with any of your children marrying into those families?
When do you say marrying into those families?
Marrying
one of my clients?
To marry into a well-known, well-established person of the mob that there was no doubt that they were involved.
I wouldn't want a child of mine to, if there was no doubt that they engaged in that lifestyle, I wouldn't want a child of mine to have the pressure that those guys have. It is not glamorous. Their lifestyle has been made glamorous by TV shows like The Sopranos and movies like Casino and the like, but it's a pretty rough life. I want my family to have an easier life than a lot of my clients have.
Oscar, you're a fascinating man, and I do appreciate the interview. And I hope you didn't feel it was a witch hunt.
I think the questions were good. I love your questions. I think they were good questions, but at the same time, as I'm sure you were sincere in your questions, I'm sincere in my answers. And it's interesting because people are talking about making movies about me and TV shows and the like, and they all come with the same thing. And it's interesting what you said. They have me as the ethical defense lawyer.
Right. And I believe that the only thing that I guess I can't personally get over is the fact that the law doesn't necessarily represent justice. It represents that which you could control, maneuver, manipulate in order. Because the smarter lawyer will always run over the dumber lawyer.
No. If the government does its job right, invariably they'll win the case.
But that's what I said. The government doesn't get the smarter lawyers.
No. The government, they win 99% of their cases, and the other 1% is usually dealt out. People don't go to trial. My clients were so vilified that I couldn't make a deal. So I had to go to trial in just about every case that I had. And when you try a case, you lose a case, you win a case. But it's a wonderful system. It's a system that takes 12 people who don't know each other, who come into a courtroom for the first time, and they don't know the parties, and they listen to the evidence. And then we ask 12 wonderful citizens, men who and women who are true to themselves, to follow the court's instruction and to return a verdict which they feel is just.
Oscar, who's believing
the fantasy? No matter how it turns out, that's why I never.
Who's believing the fantasy now? I'm all for a court system that has a professional juries who have some knowledge of the law, some knowledge of how things work, and are not so easily swayed by the person who can convince them the best has the best theatrical skills.
That's not a jury's job, isn't to fight the prosecutor or fight the defense lawyer. They're supposed to listen to the evidence and come to the appropriate verdict according to the instructions. Now, maybe with the way you're saying, maybe you want one of Hitler's judges up there who will find everybody guilty and maybe not even give them a trial, just order them into an extermination situation.
That was a little stretch, Oscar. Don't you think? I'll say it again. Professional jurors.
You won't go wrong if you do.
Professional jurors are not.
You sound like somebody who a judge will never give anybody any bail. Because they're fearful that if they give bail to a person, that somehow the person's going to violate the law again, even though bail would be appropriate.
So you're saying that a more informed juror who understands the system is actually a more dangerous juror?
No, there's no such thing as a dangerous juror. I'm just saying that.
Hold it. You just likened me to Hitler stacking the courts.
Outside the courtroom, you bring them into the courtroom, but a juror, if they know something about the case, isn't supposed to bring that knowledge into the courtroom.
No, I didn't say something about the case. I'm saying something about the way the jury system should work.
Well, I hope they don't. They're given a book. Every juror that I've ever come into contact with gets a juror's book that tells them all these things about, well, we have a pretty good country here. We have a constitution. It's not a bad country.
Yeah, but you've just said that they're not as educated as they ought to be, and I think that's the heart of the problem.
Nobody's educated as I'd like them to be. But I'd rather have a smart juror than a dumb juror. That's for damn sure.
Well, that's my point.
That was his point.
Anyway, we're running out of time. You've been wonderful. You've been gracious, and you've been direct. And I thank you for coming on the show.
Have you told them the name of my book yet?
Oh, no. We do the intro and the outro. We are going to plug your book. You know, I want everyone to go read it, and I want you to plug our radio station, okay?
I will definitely do that, but after they read the book, if they want to send it out to me, I'm happy to inscribe it and to tell them that we live in a pretty damn good country.
I think we live in the best country in the world.
No question about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice talking to two of you. Thank you. Bye.
I want to once again thank Oscar Goodman for appearing on our show. We've been looking forward to having him on for a while. Pick up a copy of his book, Being Oscar, From Mob Lawyer to Mayor of Las Vegas, on Amazon. Betsy, I've never seen you with such passion here. You know, tell me how come he got lit a fire under you.
Well, I read Bob Herbert's op-ed in the New York Times right before I came, and the first lead sentence just hit me. He said, "There's probably no city in America where women are treated worse than in Las Vegas." And this is a topic that Oscar skirted, I thought, with a great deal of cleverness. He never mentioned how degrading it is for women to be in the sex trade in Las Vegas, and what a big frat club it is out there, and a playground for machismo.
All right, so it was really that, meaning, you know, the heart of protecting, you know, both women in terms of their identity, in terms of their basic rights and basic self-esteem. Was there anything else that pissed you off about him?
Well, I thought I think he says in the book clearly, he said, "I don't glamorize the mob," but he does. He does over and over again. He is somebody who is constantly name dropping one mobster after another and praising the favors they did him and vice versa and so on. And I think he's fallen into that American trap of fantasizing organized crime. I mean, it's all part of our culture. It's been there ever since America was founded, actually. That's one of our first heroes. It's the con man. And it's a very, very powerful American myth. And I think he got caught by it. I think it bit him in the tail.
I think that he was one of the most well-spoken guests we ever had. But I think that what he did is not so much glamorize the mob as discount it, as a bunch of people who unfortunately got caught. And therefore, they may have, he said this 1,000 times, may have been guilty. When I think a lawyer's job is to exercise justice, and if his client is guilty, to try to get him in the best possible position to get the best possible rehabilitation, but not necessarily to get a guilty man off. That's just my feelings. And the other thing that got to me a little bit is that the very same thing that he was talking about Hitler's courts, when I suggested a more educated jury, he did the very same thing that is done in these fascist countries, and that is making people who have a different opinion seem like they're the fascists.
Demonizing you.
Yes. You know, which, again, he's an interesting guy. I would actually love to spend time with him. But I did find the man was smooth, had an answer to every question, and I don't know necessarily whether or not everything he said he believed.
Right, and he talks in hyperboles, everything, witch hunts, Hitler, etc.
I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Betsy and I both want you to remember to every problem there is a solution. Now, please, you're going to want to check out our other episodes, and you're going to want to tell all your friends about it because they're going to thank you. There's something for everyone. Go to www.gluckradio.com and go out and buy Betsy Prelow's books. It's now in paperback simply because it is going and going and going like the everlasting bunny. Not the everlasting bunny. It's going and going and going like...
skyrocketing.
It's going. Buy Betsy Prelow's books on The Artist Seduction on Amazon.com. They're entitled Swoon and Seductress. Keep listening and keep sending us your feedback. Till next time.